down. It is with some diffidence that I write about economic matters. I was an English major, or, as people in business call it, stupid. The best investment I've made lately? I left a $20 bill in the pocket of my tweed jacket last spring, and I just found it. But I do know enough to thank business for existing. Business investment defines humanity. Animals don't invest. If a dog has a surplus, he will eat it all and vomit it up, rather than give a portion of it to another dog in return for shares in car chasing or the chewing of shoes. Business investment defines civilization. Barbarians don't raise money through debt and equity. They raise money through stealing. Although, during the boom in subprime mortgage lending, it was sometimes difficult to tell the difference. Nonetheless, business investment is one of the most important ideas in history. If it weren't for business investment, all the inventors, innovators, manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers who have brought prosperity to the modern world would have to get their money the way the rest of us do, by asking their wives. The free market is the greatest repository of our freedoms, but the free market is dead. It was killed by the Bolshevik Revolution, fascist central planning, Keynesianism, the Great Depression, World War II economic controls, the British Labour Party victory of 1945, Keynesianism again, the Arab oil embargo, Bill Clinton's and Tony Blair's third-way economics, and the 2008 financial crisis. The free market died at least 10 times in the past century. And every time the free market expires, there is, for some reason, a flurry of renewed interest in Adam Smith. Smith preached the gospel of the free market. Economic well-being, the wealth of nations, as it were, depends solely on freedom. There is, first, the freedom to choose our method and means of economic employment, what Smith indicated by his division of labor. Second is the freedom to exchange the products of our labor for the products of other peoples. Smith championed the abolition of restraints and monopolies on commerce, a doctrine that came to be known as free trade. Third, there is the freedom to decide what it is we want to accomplish with our labors and trades. Smith termed it people's regard to their own interest. This is sometimes called pursuit of self-interest. Jefferson's more felicitous phrase is, of course, pursuit of happiness. Anyway, when the freedom of the free market leads to screw-ups, people always want to know what Adam Smith would say about market failure. It's a, "Hello, God, how's my atheism going?" moment. Adam Smith would be laughing too hard to say anything. Smith spotted the exact cause of the 2008 financial meltdown not just before it happened, but 232 years before, probably a record for advice to sell short. In Book 2, Chapter 1 of The Wealth of Nations, Smith wrote, "A dwelling house, as such, contributes nothing to the revenue of its inhabitant. If it is to be let to a tenant for rent, as the house itself can produce nothing, the tenant must always pay the rent out of some other revenue." Smith therefore concluded that although a house can make money for its owner if it's rented, the revenue of the whole body of the people can never be in the smallest degree increased by it. Bingo. Subprime mortgage collapse. Smith was familiar with rampant speculation, or overtrading, as he politely called it. The Mississippi scheme and the South Sea bubble had both collapsed in 1720, 3 years before his birth. In 1772, while Smith was writing The Wealth of Nations, a bank run occurred in Scotland. Only three of Edinburgh's 30 private banks survived. The reaction of the Scottish overtraders to the ensuing credit freeze sounds familiar. The banks, they seem to have thought, Smith said, were in honor bound to supply the deficiency and to supply them with all the capital which they wanted to trade with. According to Smith, the phenomenon of speculative excess has less to do with free markets than with high profits. "When the profits of trade happen to be greater than ordinary," he said, "overtrading becomes a general error." And rate of profit, Smith claimed, is always highest in the countries that are going fastest to ruin. Judging by how America invested in 2007 and voted in 2008, That would be us. The South Sea Bubble, offering shares in a government monopoly on trade with the Orient, was the result of machinations by Britain's Lord Treasurer Robert Harley, Earl of Oxford, who was looking to fund the national budget deficit. The Mississippi scheme, with securities backed by France's land claims in North America, was started for the same reason by the French regent Philippe, Duke d'Orléans, who gave control of the Royal Bank to Scottish financier John Law, the Charles Ponzi of his day. And the 2008 crisis was the product of interest rate manipulations by the Federal Reserve Bank under its chairman Alan Greenspan, for the same reason yet again. John Law's fellow Scots, who were more inclined to favor market freedoms than the English, let alone the French, had already heard Law's plan for establishing a bank which he seems to have imagined might issue paper to the amount of the whole value of all the lands in the country. The Parliament of Scotland, Smith noted, did not think proper to adopt it. A single misconception allows overtrading folly to turn into speculative disaster, whether the overtrading involves commercial monopoly, Louisiana wilderness, tulip bulbs, dot-com stocks, or home mortgages. The misconception is that unlimited expansion of prosperity can be created by unlimited expansion of credit. Wild flights of borrowing can be effected only with what Smith called the Dedalian wings of paper money. To produce enough of this paper requires either government or something able to put the arm on government the way modern financial institutions can. They are too blank, pick your adjective, to fail. The U.S. government likes to peddle its powers. Financiers like to shop their influence. Smith pointed out, the government of an exclusive company of merchants is, perhaps, the worst of all governments. Business people are innately no better than other people. Some may be as bad as politicians. But the political power of government is required to let business people do their worst. Given that power, it's easy. The plan that Adam Smith put forth for creating prosperity is more complicated. It involves all the baffling intricacies of human liberty. Smith proposed the frighteningly complex program of everybody being free, free of bondage and of political, economic, and regulatory oppression. Smith once told a learned society in Edinburgh that little else is requisite to carry a state to the highest degree of opulence but peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice. With Smith's clear understanding of political inclinations in matters of adjudication, exaction, and war, we can guess the tone of sarcasm in which he spoke. How would Adam Smith fix a mess such as the current recessionary aftermath of financial collapse? Sorry, but it's fixed already. The answer to a decline in the value of speculative assets is to pay less for them. Job done. We could pump the banks full of our national treasure, but, Smith said, to attempt to increase the wealth of any country, either by introducing or by detaining in it an unnecessary quantity of gold and silver, is as absurd as it would be to attempt to increase the good cheer of private families by obliging them to keep an unnecessary number of kitchen utensils. We could send in the experts to manage financial institutions, but, Smith said, I have never known much good done by those who affect to trade for the public good. And we could nationalize our economy, but, Smith said, the state cannot be very great of which the sovereign has leisure to carry on the trade of a wine merchant or apothecary, or run General Motors. Opposition to the free market is forever expressed in outrage at capitalist success. Capitalism exploits workers, robs widows and orphans, and concentrates wealth in the hands of the rapacious few. Speaking as a capitalist, if only. Critics of the free market think of capitalists as being Donald Trump and the faceless, and therefore even more wicked, partners at Goldman Sachs. Were it true that the free market did nothing but breed flocks of Donald Trumps and packs of Wall Street grab-alls, it wouldn't be just the left that's out to get them. The rest of us would be hunting them for sport. But that's not all the free market does. That's not who capitalists are. and capitalism is by no means a product of the free market anyway. To undertake a material project, whether it's a great pyramid of Khufu, an Atlantic City casino, a hospital for widows and orphans, or a papier-mâché Gandhi puppet for the annual peace pageant at the Waldorf School, requires a fund of accumulated resources of some kind, no matter if it's just paste and recycled paper. This is capital. Capital can come from savings. Capital can come from borrowings. Capital can come from consideration given in return for proportionate ownership of the project in hand. Capital can come from paper money that a central bank has pulled out of its ass. Kings, republics, communist dictatorships, Microsoft, the Salvation Army, and Somali pirates all need capital, and they all discover ways to obtain it. Capitalism, so-called, is when free people accumulate capital of their own free will for use on freely determined projects. The fact of the matter is that most of these projects flop. Donald Trump, for example. Every property he touches seems to go to hell. Fat cat would be the wrong epithet for Trump. If someone other than paroled former Enron accountants were keeping his books, he'd probably be shown to have a net worth less than that of your 20-pound tabby who just shredded the drapes. What's good about the free market is that it allows capitalism to, so to speak, trump success. The free market lets capitalism fail. Think of all the wonderful money-making ideas people get. And you've probably had some of these ideas yourself. Chocolate-covered hairballs to give your feline something yummy to cough up. A line of bottled water for dogs with flavors such as puddle, pond scum, and toilet bowl. Plastic garbage bags that solve the annoying which side's up problem by being open on both ends. Scented candles for men. Mandels. That fill a guy's home with smells of pool hall, old dog, gear oil, beer, and frying meat. Home colonoscopy kits. And fun screen to protect children from dangerous exposure to fun. Use FPF 40 if the kid has a skateboard. In a free market, people, notably my stockbroker, invest money in these things and in businesses such as a chain of restaurants run by Wolfgang Puck's younger, dumber brother, Hockey, an Orthodox Jewish wilderness outfitter whose guides specialize in catching gefilte fish on dry flies, a way to cash in on recession thrift with a day-old sushi bar, low-cost off-season foliage tours of New England featuring bus trips through Vermont in March, and a deal to mitigate the effects of both the mortgage lending crisis and climate change by buying all the sub-zero freezers from foreclosed McMansions and renting them as affordable housing to polar bears. Imagine a world where all such schemes come to fruition. You've just imagined a cross between North Korea and Dubai. And you've just explained where those Bulgarian blue jeans came from. Bad ideas can also happen in democratic societies where the full range of freedoms, including the freedom to fail, are presumed to exist. At the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009, America conducted an economic intervention that kept businesses that were staggering around, intoxicated by overtrading and blinded by MBA moonshine, from falling down the manhole of liquidation. The business of government is failure-proof. Social Security finances have, over the past 30 years, arrived at a condition that would make the most hardened trader of collateralized debt obligations blanch. America is on the verge of having a huge surplus of retirees. Government subsidies produce surpluses because subsidies always produce surpluses, the way they did with America's subsidized wheat and cheese. Subsidized surpluses, their prices fixed by law, do not respond to the usual methods. Absolutely final going out of politics sale of clearing markets. What will we do with all the old people? We may have to, as we did with the wheat and cheese, donate them overseas in hope of aiding developing countries that lack age, wisdom, and the early bird special at Denny's. Fortunately, most of America is still allowed to fail. Economic failure, however, harms good business as well as bad. The arrogant and greedy come a cropper, but so do the innovators and visionaries. And this is fine, too. Per the Adam Smith analogy, Icarus, with youth's ready affinity for new technology, sees all sorts of possibilities in flight. These elude his Earth-oriented sandal-tech father, Daedalus, who just wants to get out of Crete. Icarus takes off on his own. He experiences the thrill of a soaring venture, briefly becomes a hot property, gets his wings singed, has a meltdown, and undergoes a rapid decline in personal fortune. So it went with the internet bubble, and so it had gone before with the railroads. Trains are another example of a visionary innovation that suffered a valuable fizzle. Railroad building was vital to America's business expansion, but speculation in railroad stock offerings in the 1870s led to a dot-com of a crash. Good as railroads are, what if every proposed railroad had succeeded? Do we want a rail bed in the driveway? Would it be convenient to take the train into the McDonald's drive-through lane? It's probably no coincidence that shortly after the railroad bust, the automobile was invented. A too visionary adoption of innovation can be disruptive, as the residents of Nagasaki could attest. Private developers of an atomic bomb would have realized that the device has detrimental side effects and exposes investors to numerous class action lawsuits. Venture capital for the Manhattan Project would have dried up. If, for instance, the Segway had been introduced in the visionary, innovative late 1990s, we'd be up to our handlebars in the things. Segways would be whizzing along our sidewalks, caroming off baby carriages, causing havoc among dog walkers, squashing the sleeping homeless and forcing joggers to run for their lives. Teenage boys, with youth's ready affinity for new technology, would hot-rod the Segway. Mall racing would ensue with grisly accidents and loss of life, or, anyway, toes. Congressional hearings would be held. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration would get involved. Airbags, shoulder restraints, and stand belts would be mandated, plus two extra wheels to ensure stability. The Segway by now would be a car. As it is, the Segway was introduced in the more cautious and pragmatic early 2000s. Thus, the Segway had a chance to prove itself on its own merits and become gradually integrated with the social fabric as a useful device for making law enforcement officers look ridiculous. The free market teaches us a lesson in the value of failure. And, after all, it is not just the growth of an economy that depends on failure, so does the growth of a democracy. In America, unlike, say, Zimbabwe, the political system is based on politicians being losers. John Quincy Adams swiped the White House from Andrew Jackson in 1824. Jackson had fought duels and Indians and the British, but Old Hickory chose to wait for a metaphorical bloodbath in 1828 rather than start a real one. Nor did the combative lawyer Samuel J. Tilden stoop to battle the crooked ascendancy of Rutherford B. Hayes in 1876. And after the Florida recount and imbroglio of 2000, Al Gore conceded gracefully, more or less. Only once, following the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860, did prominent American politicians refuse to accept the blessings of failure. They started the Civil War, a terrible failure that's kept our nation free and united ever since. To failure, we owe our form of government, and also our actual physical form. Death was biology's greatest invention. Without death, there's no you. I just keep dividing into endless replications, the whole bunch of myself forging a lifestyle truly open to the criticism of being all about me. Failure is obviously the key to Darwinian selection. Survival of the fittest can't work if the unfit are still hanging around. There they go, dodging comet collisions, being chased by predators, but always managing to escape, getting stuck in tar pits, then extraditing themselves somehow, getting tar all over the place. It drives the fittest mad. Failure is necessary to evolution, but equally necessary to creationism. Picture Adam and Eve, after an eternity, all talked out, with the thrill of nudity long expired. Adam keeps mowing and dethatching and reseeding paradise. He's given up golf. He doesn't have the swear words for it. He futzes, putting the billionth coat of Thompson's water seal on the fence around the Tree of Knowledge. Eve redecorates Eden. It's Olympus this eon, Valhalla the next, then a modern minimalist nirvana. She changes all the names for the animals and stares at the fig tree, hoping for something new and stunning in this year's leaf. The beasts of the field are tired of one another. The lion lies down with the lamb snores. The serpent ends up eating all the apples himself. He's too fat to go out and do any tempting. From this, we're supposed to fill a Bible? It seems unfair that failure is essential to every aspect of freedom. Economic freedom, political freedom, the freedom of existence itself. But freedom is not fair. Much can be made of the fact, I suppose. Personally, I'm immune to the complaint. I have a 12-year-old daughter, Muffin. All I hear is, "It's not fair, it's not fair, it's not fair." I say to her, "Honey, you're cute. That's not fair. You're smart. That's not fair. You were born in the United States of America. That's not fair. Darling, you had better get down on your knees and pray to God that things don't start getting fair for you." 5. The murderous, perverted, nuptial bliss method of establishing political principles. We can formulate some powerful, free, and responsible ideas about government if we keep kill, fuck, marry in mind. But first, to clear the ideological air, let's confess that there are no conspiracies that rule the world. There's no universe-mastering cabal of capitalists, communists, Islamic fundamentalists, International Monetary Fund executives, Federal Reserve Bank governors, New World Order functionaries with their UN black helicopters, Trilateral Commission initiates, Freemasons, Bavarian Illuminati, Rosicrucians, Knights Templar, Mafia families, Chinese triads, Mexican drug gangs, Jesuits, or Google. And no, 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 it's not the Jews. They'd do a better job. The presidential birther, the 9/11 truther, the JFK assassination grassy knoller, and every other conspiracy buff is announcing aloud, "The world is so stupid that even I can understand it." Footnote. But good news for birthers, while the nativity of the current chief executive may have occurred in Hawaii or in Kenya or away in a manger, no crib for his bed, here are 8 presidents who definitely weren't born in the United States of America: George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, and William Henry Harrison. End note. All conspiracy theories are based on the assumptions that, first, any group of people numbering 2 or more can agree on anything for longer than it takes to get another beer from the refrigerator, and, second, that they'll keep their mouths shut. People are so liable to tell secrets that if, for example, people don't have any embarrassing secrets to tell about themselves, they'll make some up. No motivation is sufficient to induce mankind to be effectively secretive. The minute we have a secret, we make a Tiger Woods of ourselves. Then there are the supposed unconscious, involuntary, or automatic conspiracies that history engages us in, such as the Marxist class struggle. It's over. The social class known as assholes won. The inevitabilities of dialectical materialism, of the march of progress, of globalization, the Internet, Francis Fukuyama's end of history, and even climate change are fictions after the fact. This is not to say they aren't true. It's just to say that, with a little imagination, anyone can explain the course of human events from the minutest cause to the grandest effect. For want of a nail, the shoe is lost. For want of a shoe, the horse is lost. For want of a horse, the rider is lost. For want of something to fill poor Richard's almanac, a proverb is swiped from 17th-century metaphysical poet George Herbert, and, for want of a better idea, Benjamin Franklin's resulting prosperity and social prominence leads to independence for the 13 American colonies. There are always groups of people upon whom to blame things. The Flemish, if you're a Walloon. The Walloons, if you're Flemish. Both of them, and the rest of the dorks in Brussels, if you're an EU citizen. But there's no group of people upon whom to blame everything. Except in a free and democratic society where we can, with confidence, blame everything on ourselves. And what about ourselves? We're individuals, unique, disparate, and willful, as anyone raising a house full of little individuals knows. and not one of these children has ever written a letter to Santa Claus saying, "Please bring me and a bunch of kids I don't know a pony, and we'll share." The great religions regard us as individuals, treating sin and salvation as individual matters, at least most of the time. There are occasional group discounts, such as with the Sixth Commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," unless you all get together and attack the Canaanites. We Christians don't say our prayers as if we are responding to random polling of the likely blessed with a plus or minus 5% margin of error on "Thy will be done." Buddhists don't have a graduated meditation rate that shifts the burden of enlightenment to those with greater assets in the sitter department. And Allah doesn't welcome believers into paradise saying, "You weren't a good Muslim, but you were standing in a crowd of good Muslims when you detonated the explosives in your suicide vest." Virtue is famously lonesome, and vice is pretty solitary for some of us, too. We experience pain and pleasure individually, which is what showed President Clinton to be such a pigeon plucker when he told us he felt our pain. We forgave him because we were spared feeling his icky pleasures. Making a statement of individuality is not the same as professing a philosophy of individualism with loud cries of "me first." Individuality is, like the free market, a measurement, not a moral argument. Individuals are the units we come in. Basing a political system on something other than individuals, communes, collectives, identity groups, Twitter-generated flash mobs, Grateful Dead followers still wondering where the heck to go, isn't wrong, it's stupid. It's like having a counting system that goes few, less, some, more, none. Even within a family, people have to be treated as individuals, otherwise we stuff a tampon up Dad, give Mom a table saw for Valentine's Day, and turn the toddler loose on the rider mower. Therefore, if we were inventing a new political system... Stop. We do not want to invent new political systems. Whenever people tell you they are going to wipe the slate clean, it's your slate they mean to wipe. The political systems that we have already are plenty bad enough. Newly invented political systems mean Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, Lenin, Mao, Pol Pot, or, at best, Che Guevara. Best because the Bolivians killed him before he caused any trouble. Political systems cannot be treated as if they were blueprints from Habitat for Humanity, drawn to a conscious plan and given a fixed start date. The social engineering involved in political subdevelopment such as these leads to bodies buried in the basement. Nor were existing political systems created intentionally for reasons bad or good. There is a notion that somewhere in a dusty archive or dog-eared poli-sci textbook, there's something called a social contract. It was mentioned first by Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century, then by John Locke, and later by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Hobbes thought that man had surrendered liberties to government in return for order and safety. Locke thought that man had volunteered powers to government in return for safety and order. And Rousseau thought... He thought all sorts of things. He was French. Just where and when did hairy ape-men come down from the trees and speak to the fine points of this agreement before speech was invented? Who decided how many Uggs would be in the Grunstitution? Few? Less? Some? More? None? The rule of political systems is that we must play the hand we're dealt lest we be shuffled and discarded. Or this would be the rule of political systems if it weren't for the fact that 230-odd years ago, some hicks sat down in a flea barn in a no-account burg in what might as well have been Borneo and invented a new political system that's been the envy and astonishment of the world ever since. We know nothing about where political systems come from. We don't even know where they don't come from. And considering the shiftless, slave-trading, bed-hopping, debt-ducking, and that's just Thomas Jefferson, nature of America's founding fathers, who also included rum-soaked bunkum merchants and Indian-massacring land-swindlers, and they all oppressed women and weren't vegans, we should be careful about saying that certain societies or nationalities or religious persuasions aren't ready for democracy. As I was saying, if we were inventing a new political system, the first question should be, what is good for everyone? By everyone, we ought to mean everyone as in every one. The question can't be, what is good for one? That's monomaniacal and results in a political system like the New Hampshire presidential primary. The question can't be, what is good for someone? Everything's good for someone. The New Hampshire presidential primary is good for someone who owns a Motel 6 in Keene, New Hampshire. The question can't even be, what's good for almost everyone, or everyone who matters, or the majority of everyone who gives a shit. Political systems always end up asking these questions. The place where things end can't be the place to begin. Unless politics is as much like a monopoly board as leftists say it is. Finally, the question can't be, what is good for everyone as a whole? There is no whole. Individuals are available only individually. A complete set cannot be collected, even by force. No matter how newly inventive we're being with our political system, we should take a few lessons from the past. The philosopher George Santayana told us that when we ignore history, we're doomed to repeat it. And if high school is anything to go by, the same is true for civics. Footnote. Santayana managed to ignore World War II. He was in Rome when the conflict broke out. He moved into an Italian convent and stayed there until his demise in 1952. What Santayana was doing in the Italian convent, we don't know. But he wasn't killed, and he wasn't married to death. End note. Mankind has made improvements in living conditions over the past couple of million years. Some people don't think so. To those people, I say, dentistry. The improvements that have been good for everyone are those that have increased the dignity of the individual, have given the individual broader scope, greater self-accountability, and more authority over everything in the world, except other individuals who have the authority to tell the first individual to butt out. Judaism provided individuals with one God and one law, before whom all men are equal regardless of wealth and rank. Christianity pointed out that every individual has precious intrinsic worth, even the most lowly among us, such as those we vote for in the New Hampshire presidential primary. The growth of trade and private enterprise let individuals acquire autonomy and material goods by means other than delving in muck and killing each other. And the Industrial Revolution allowed millions, now billions, of individuals to lead a housed, clothed, and fed life, albeit with some unfortunate side effects, such as those polar bears living in our sub-zero freezers. So there we have it. A political system that consists entirely of us individuals, each of us entirely free. All that we free individuals have to do now is ask each other, what do we want? And be told to shut up. There's no way to learn the infinite wants of myriad individuals, and why are we so nosy anyhow? Yet we do know some things that we want from a political system, whether we care to know or not. What we want from even the freest political system is relief from freedom. Freedom is not a tranquil condition. Witness all the killing, fucking, and marrying involved. We want order and safety per Hobbes and Locke. That is, we want the police, the army, and TSA to be on the lookout for other people. Thank you. But we also want somewhere to turn when our weather, our economy, our health, our luck, or ourself screws up. Some people cannot enjoy the benefits of freedom without assistance from their fellows. This may be a temporary condition, such as childhood, and when I say I can drive home from the bar at 3 a.m. just fine. Or, due to infirmity or affliction, the condition may be permanent. Aid must be given. Assets must be redistributed. All political systems are redistributive. The most rigidly individualistic political theorist can't get away from redistribution. The theorist might wish he could invoke the fuck you clause in the kill fuck marry paradigm when it comes to poor people, but there are always more poor people than political theorists. The poor people may go for the kill. Also, there's the sympathy, compassion, and basic human decency embedded deep within our souls. embedded so deep that they're often invisible and sometimes impossible to find. But we won't admit that. We may not have a conscience, but we do have something inside that keeps us from announcing that we don't. This something may be, again, the fear that everyone will kill us. Political systems are redistributive because every political system is modeled to some extent on the original political system, the family, that hotbed of communism. Within a family, the dictum of Marx is valid, from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. But the family is not a good model for a political system. For one thing, Marxism ceases to work when it is extended outside the family by even so much as the factor of one bum brother-in-law. For another thing, think about your family. Or worse, think about mine. Talk about kill, fuck, marry. There are branches of my family too loony even for jobs in government. Now imagine that my family occupies hundreds of thousands of square miles and is made up of tens of millions of people too loony even for jobs in government. It's California. On the other hand, what's a better model for a political system than the family? The coral reef is okay as long as we don't have to go anywhere. Animal Farm has been tried. Facebook would be weird. In the makeup of a halfway decent political system, the quality of freedom, including the free market, the quantity of individuality, and the fact of redistribution are fair assumptions, I assume. Redistribution is where the political fun begins. How much, of what, to whom, by which means, and where the hell do we get it from? This is the crux of the liberal versus conservative argument in modern democracies. Let us say that the argument is, does size matter? And that liberals and conservatives are bickering about the amount of redistribution to be done. This isn't quite true, but it's close enough for government work. Let us say further, liars though we may be, that both the left and the right mean well, and that each wants what is good for everyone. Redistribution still causes a huge fight. People are never going to agree about it. The quarrel will go on forever. And let's hope it does. An end to the argument would be horrible. The moment when we're all in accord about every social benefit with which we all will be provided forever is the moment when we enter my 12-year-old daughter Muffin's alternate universe where everything is fair. You don't want to go there. Pink blasting on the iPod speakers, the laptop glowing with snarky BFF emails, the stinking hamster cage, the huge polyester tangle of the abandoned My Little Pony collection, floors a fathom deep in wadded-up Aeropostale outfits, tattered Twilight books, fruit roll-ups, and half-chewed gum. There are snits, there are sulks, there is bitter sarcasm apropos of nothing. And you'd better hope you're not a younger sister. For younger sisters, life really is hell where everything is fair. A few nonpartisan, or at least not very political, observations can be made about redistribution. When any authority of any kind undertakes to redistribute goods and services, we can be sure we'll be told that what goes to the poor has come from the rich. Those who are indignant at the rich say so. The indignant rich do too. But who's rich? You are. To someone who lives in the slums of Karachi, you're rich. I don't care if you're driving a 1990 Geo Tracker, haven't had a job since Cher was a babe, and your trailer home just burned down because your wife's boyfriend's meth lab exploded. You're rich. You're farting through silk as far as that person in Karachi who's looking for a job as a suicide bomber is concerned. Accusing someone of being rich is like accusing someone of adultery in the Gospel of St. John. Let he who is without anything anybody wants cast the first vote. We all praise the virtue of sharing, but perform the following thought experiment about the sharing process. Imagine that your family is matched by lot with five other families, and that the resulting half-dozen familial units must pool their resources and come to mutual decisions about how those resources are to be allocated. For a brief moment, that sounds like an intriguing combination of reality TV and the 1960s. Then we recall what an awful combination reality TV and the 1960s would have been. The Real Housewives of Charlie Manson. Since we've already determined that you're rich, let's institute a requirement that the other five families be poorer than yours. And why is a small bad idea like this supposed to get better if you make it bigger? It stinks in your hometown. How is it going to smell nationwide? Nor does the idea improve if you shrink it. How small would that pool of resource sharers need to be to make it practical, sane, and unstupid? Even within our immediate families, we don't share our resources fairly, as Muffin is totally fond of pointing out. And in most families, collective decision-making doesn't rise above the level of hamster purchase. My dogs favor having the hamster, with a side of fries. What if the shared resource pool is restricted to only a married couple? Surprise divorce filing! And your spouse's lawyer just called to say you're rich. Another rule of redistribution can be extrapolated from a family circle. Never do anything to or for a stranger that you wouldn't do to or for your bum brother-in-law. I'd like to note here that I have a perfectly respectable set of brothers-in-law, an engineer, an industrial designer, a medical researcher, and a deceased career military man. So it's your bum brother-in-law we're talking about. You can't let your sister and her five kids by six different fathers starve, but you can try to make her husband get a job. And you can, at least in my state, run him off at gunpoint if he beats her. Or say your brother-in-law isn't a bad guy, just drunk and crazy and high on drugs. He's living on the street and talking to people who don't exist. Do you pick him up by his collar and belt, heave him in the back of your car and get him some help? Or do you respect his civil rights and let him freeze in doorways and get run over by a bus? Yeah, I'm for the bus myself. But you know the kind of fit your sister is going to pitch at the funeral, screaming and yelling, and that will get your mom started and you'll never hear the end of it. We're in the same situation, politically, as we are with our sister. We have to help. But when an over-collectivized political system is allowed to make all the decisions about who gets help, we end up helping some people who are hardly helpless. Maybe they're worthy people whom we love dearly, but we still don't feel obligated to share our resources with them. For instance, there you are, scraping along, three kids in school, and the house worth half what it was a few years ago. And your dad needs a knee replacement. Let's say your dad, served three terms in Congress and then went to work as a Washington lobbyist so that his net worth is, $200 million. Do you pay for the knee operation? What's the old fart still doing on the tennis court anyway? And will somebody tell me why the goddamn hell Medicare isn't means-tested? Redistribution is practiced in every democratic political system, and allegedly practiced in most of the systems that aren't democratic. This is well and good, as long as we're mindful that, a lot of the time, redistribution works about as much as your brother-in-law. Power, freedom, and responsibility are the main features of our politics. We pay with our freedoms to relieve ourselves of our responsibilities. And this is how others get their power over us. Maybe a nicer way to put it is, we come together in a political system to share the burden of our responsibilities. Except that's bullshit. We snatch the material resources that constitute freedom from everywhere and everyone we can. We're such thieves of freedom that we pick our own pockets, and we turn these resources over to politicians so power-mad they're willing to endure the filth of politics to gain the least bit of mastery over their fellows. If we do our stealing for the sake of Hobbesian order and safety, we're not much to blame. But a look at government expenditure indicates that safety and order aren't our first concerns. According to the 2009 federal budget, we're spending $651.2 billion on defense and $26.6 billion on administration of justice. Add this to the $91.8 billion that we spend, quite rightly, on veterans' benefits, and we get a total of $769.6 billion in Hobbesian diminishments of our freedom. $2,500 or so apiece, and worth it. Or we hope so. But in the same year, we're spending $694.8 billion on Social Security, $420.1 billion on Medicare, $360.8 $316.8 billion on the other government-funded health care services, $54.2 billion on income security, including unemployment, disability, and welfare benefits, $12.2 billion on social services providing vocational education and training, $22.6 billion on the agricultural subsidies that everyone wants to kill, and $38.3 billion on humanitarian foreign aid. That's $1.5 trillion. A lot of giving. We're giving until it hurts. That is, we're giving until it hurts other people, since we're giving more than we've got. Do we need to employ the untrustworthy and rapacious power of government to effect the redistribution that our political system requires? We'll never know. We're too busy running up to our untrustworthy government leaders and thrusting gifts of additional rapacious power upon them so that we don't have to take care of Grandma. She doesn't know who we are anymore, and she smells. Even if Hobbes and Locke had been talking crap and there never was such a thing as an internal or external threat to society, people would still form governments just to shirk responsibility. It's kill, fuck, marry again. In our political heart of hearts, we're all 22, rich, and beautiful. We fuck all we want, then we get an abortion or ask the National Institutes of Health to kill the HIV virus, and if we do get married, it's just for a couple of months. Don't forget the prenup. 6. The Purgatory of Freedom and the Hell of Politics. The best way to have a good political system is to avoid politics. But political disengagement deprives us of opportunities for bitching at politicians and pushing them around. This is occasionally useful and always a pleasure. In our democracy, we don't get in trouble by trying to make politicians mad. We get in trouble by trying to make them like us. Our political system goes to hell when we want it to give us things. There are certain things we may reasonably demand of our political system, of course, but most of these things are negative rights. And often it's the political system itself that's violating those rights. The most sensible request we make of government is not do something, but quit it. As for our positive rights and the goodies we expect to gain with them, we're confusing politics with Halloween. Politicians don't mind. They love devising programs of incentives and disincentives for the populace. Trick or treat. And a ghouls and goblins political system is fine for those among us who are really scary. But for the rest of us, don't be surprised if we go house to house, White House to House of Representatives to Senate, and ringing doorbells as furiously as we may, get nothing but healthy fruit. If there's something we want, politics shouldn't be our first resort. Politics is all taking, no making. Whatever politics provides for us will be obtained from other people. Those people won't love us. And we don't love them. When we gain our ends through political takings, it's because of a certain bad idea. What we're thinking leads to death, destruction, and taxes. What we're thinking is that we live in a zero-sum world. There is a fixed amount of the things I want, and when anybody has anything I want, they've taken it from me. If you get too many slices of pizza, I have to eat the Domino's box. This is a particularly poisonous idea, because for most of history it was true. There may have been a prehistorical moment when all we had to do to get more mammoth meat was walk over the next hill and avail ourselves of some unpopulated spot, such as Europe. But civilization is based on land for grazing and crops. There's only so much land. If I'm on it, you're off. That's the world's shortest history of warfare, and probably also the history of class conflict, serfdom, slavery, nationalism, racism, and genocide. Zero-sum thinking is a name for envy. Ovid, in his Metamorphoses, gives an apt description of the House of Envy, as a poet in that most zero-sum of political systems the Roman Empire might. Envy within, busy at the meal of snake's flesh, her tongue dripped venom. Only the sight of suffering could bring a smile to her lips. She never knew the comfort of sleep, but looked with dismay on men's good fortune. She could hardly refrain from weeping when she saw no cause for tears. I didn't know Hillary Clinton's involvement in politics dated back to the reign of Augustus. Then one day the idea of zero sum wasn't true. We see its falsehood being revealed by population growth during the late Middle Ages in Europe and India and China, with timeouts for Black Death, massacring invasions, and the 30 Years' War. The Industrial Revolution would further this population trend, but the original human anti-Malthusianism doesn't seem to have been the result of science or invention. Adam Smith thought the cause was simple expansion of trade, giving farmers a motive to grow more food than was needed just for eating, reseeding, and the rats. By now, there shouldn't be a zero-sum thought left in our heads. We should be free of all zero-sums begrudgings. We know we can make more of everything. Energy, to name one. When did our vital supply of lamp-lighting whale oil run out? We didn't notice because we were too busy inventing kerosene and electricity. Once again, India and China, Europe not so much, are showing the way with the vast expansions of their economies. We can bake more pizza, or naan, as the case may be. We can clone more cows. We can raise more plants, under grow lights in the closets of our off-campus apartments. There's even additional beachfront property on its way, thanks to climate change and seaside development in Greenland. Celebrity offers the ultimate disproof of zero sum. The amount of celebrity was always limited by the need for something to celebrate. Click through your cable channels. Not now. But there is one field of endeavor where zero sum remains the awful truth. Politics. Even in the most free and democratic country, politics is about power. There's a fixed quantity of power because there's a fixed quantity of me. Power you have over me is power I lose to you. And political power is different from other power because political systems are different from other social systems. A political system has the legal monopoly on deadly force. We're all involved in a variety of social systems, such as that bunch of social snobs with their system of blackballing us at the country club. They're allowed to ban us from the tees, but they aren't allowed to pick us off with sniper fire from their clubhouse bar. Governments can. Nothing sums up zero sum like death. Because government is zero sum, there aren't two congressmen wedging their fat butts into the same seat in the House of Representatives. We don't have 300 million Supreme Court justices telling 9 old Washington shysters in black bathrobes whether they'll get a lawyer at Gitmo. The chiefs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff aren't all commander-in-chiefs commanding forward march to one another until they collide in a group hug. Political power is awful, and power is awful anyway. Lord Acton, one of 19th-century Britain's great defenders of liberty, wrote, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." This was in a letter to Anglican Bishop Mandell Creighton, and the subject was papal infallibility, something Acton, a devout Catholic, argued against at the First Vatican Council. Sure, and if power can do the likes of that to the Holy Father in Rome, just think what it's done to Harry Reid. We have to be careful about giving power to people, for their own sake, among every other reason. We won't get our power back easily. And when we try to get our power back, it isn't pretty. Washington at Valley Forge, Paris during the Reign of Terror, the Tsar's family at Yekaterinburg. Nonetheless, we are continually tempted to confer power on government, to delegate our power, as some would have it, to alienate our power, as Jefferson would have been more likely to say. And it's not only a desire to escape from our responsibilities that tempts us. The American government is a huge tool, a formidable engine, mighty in its operation and nearly irresistible in its movement. Never mind that it doesn't know where it's going. The temptation is to use a tool like this when something needs fixing. Whether the tool suits the task isn't a question we always ask ourselves, as those of us who receive Home Depot gift certificates on Father's Day can attest. Maybe we shouldn't change the battery in our wristwatch with the electric drill. But what if it's a cordless DeWalt with a 3/8-inch chuck and 50 different bits? Or, to put the case differently, the government is a Rottweiler ready to be unleashed on your problems, and you've stuffed raw meat down the front of your pants. One method of being careful with government power is to think about our messy government the way we think about our messy personal lives. There are furious ex-spouses, bitter former lovers, and various outstanding child support judgments. We don't want too much of this in one place, which is why we moved to Phoenix. America's founding fathers knew enough about messy personal lives to make sure that the chief concerns of the Constitutional Convention were a federalist decentralization of power and a system by which each branch of government would check the other branches of government and balance their power with power of its own. What if all the ex-spouses, former lovers, and kids whose school fees we're supposed to be paying become friends and get the same lawyer? America's founding fathers would have rather moved to Phoenix than let this happen. It is a good idea for as much government power as possible to be distributed to the smallest possible units of government, the cities, towns, townships, and counties that are scattered all over the United States, plus those scattered states themselves. John Sununu, former governor of New Hampshire and chief of staff to President George H.W. Bush, is a cantankerous and truthful man. He's also an engineer. He compares reliance on local government to a goal of mechanical engineering, short control loops. The hot and cold faucets in your shower are a short control loop. If, instead of being located in the shower stall, those hot and cold faucets were in the basement, that would be a long control loop. This is not to say that a short control loop always works. You may be out of hot water. But it's better to stand in the shower fiddling with a useless faucet than to march naked and dripping through the house, amazing the children and shocking the cleaning lady down two flights of stairs into the grungy basement, and fiddle with a useless faucet there. If our neighbor on the local sewer commission votes to raise our sewer rates, we can go next door and yell at him or stuff a potato up the tailpipe of his car. Stuffing a potato up the tailpipe of the limousine of the President of the United States is a federal crime. Or they'll make it one if we try. Despite the clear and evident sense of the short control loop argument, we are deaf to it. When something's wrong, we don't consult the sewer commissioner next door, even if what's wrong is backed up sewage. We go straight to Washington, and, bypassing even the House and the Senate, expect the president himself to take time off from trying to get his limo started and come over to our house with a plunger. We do this not just because we're morons, but because federal government in the United States is more efficient, less corrupt, and harder working than state and local governments. Illinois. Say no more. The federal government attracts the biggest talents in administration, legislation, jurisprudence, and bureaucracy. And those talents are exercised under the greatest scrutiny because the news media pay attention to the federal government. All this makes for a good thing. Of its kind. In the shark tank, the juiciest bait attracts the biggest sharks. If that juicy bait happens to be something interesting, such as we, the drowning taxpayers, attention will be paid. The only effective way to keep power decentralized is by making sure our society provides ungovernmental ways of being powerful. The biggest talents should be offered bait in places other than Washington. Let the good and the great flounce around in the arts, spout pious bilge from pulpits, fill the minds of the young with drivel at great universities, spread patronizing smarm through charitable organizations and rob all comers in business. Just one ready, necessary thing is needed to set the hook in this lure of decentralization. Thank God for money. And whenever we meet a rich person, however loathsome, we should be sure to say, "Thanks. The disgusting fact of your existence helps spread the manure of life around and keeps it from piling up in one spot under the Capitol dome." Political power, however, remains the most powerful of powers, so people will continue to be drawn to it. What kind of people we know too well. The politician's personality has been brilliantly described. A pervasive pattern of grandiosity in fantasy or behavior. Need for admiration, beginning by early adulthood, as indicated by five or more of the following. 1. Has grandiose sense of self-importance, for example, exaggerates achievements and talents, expects to be recognized as superior without commensurate achievements. 2. Is preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance. 3. believes that he or she is special and unique and can only be understood by or should associate with other special or high-status people or institutions. 4. Requires excessive admiration.